Welcome, everyone, to the start of this new series on the 10 ox herding pictures, which is a Zen pictorial display of the journey of awakening. And I really love it as a metaphor and depiction of how the journey moves through each one of us in some way or fashion of others, because it's not a Buddhist metaphor or a Christian metaphor, but it really covers, it's a generic one, it really covers the broad expanse of the pitfalls and peaks of what it means to come into a true orientation and direction of one's authentic spiritual growth. And I have been reading some of what the ancient Zen teachers say, and some of the pictures always are very interesting to me. They're kind of cryptic, as sometimes Japanese pictures are. But the first one of these series is called Seeking the Ox. Seeking the Ox, and that's the title of tonight's talk. And as we go through this, before I show you these pictures, it really, no matter where we are, there is a time in each of our practice when seeking is what we will be doing, regardless of how sophisticated we may think we are, or where we might think we are in relationship to these 10 pictures. Each of us will fall back from time to time to square one. And at other times we will be so settled, we may miss the fact that have journeyed far into the reaches of these pictures and where they seem to be pointing. And so they're not a series of linear steps. They're much more of a spiral staircase in which they will go through them again and again, time and time again. Because understanding is not fixed. Understanding is fluid. And as you go and as we journey deeper into ourselves and we see particular orientation and we light up with inspiration and insight, and then we come out of that particular context and back into the daily life patterns, that insight may fade. We go back into the perhaps angst of our previous lifestyle prior to that insight, wondering what happened, where was that, how can I bring it forward again? Perhaps in panic we may try to search it out or read about it somehow to bring it to the surface. It's not that it has gone away. Insight can't vanish. It's like having a clean window in front of you and taking a diamond and scratching an etch on the glass. The etch is there, but if you're looking out of the wrong area of that glass, you may not see it. And at other times when you deepen and go back into a particular depth of understanding or practice or stillness, that etch is very clearly marked upon that glass and you'll come back into that understanding. So there need not be a panic that you have lost anything. Nothing is ever lost in meditation. Nothing is ever lost in your spiritual journey. If it has been truly insightfully etched into our spirit. So that not to fear that we have wasted our life. Much of what we call wasted our life is the journey towards the very provision and direction that allows for that etching to take place. In fact, when we begin to wonder where all of our spiritual journey began, it's hard to mark the beginning, isn't it, if you look at it? It's hard to say that on this particular date, maybe I started to meditate or came to Rodney's classes, but that may not and probably is not the beginning of your spiritual journey. And if you look back the decades previous, you'll see little points in which there was a movement, a turning towards, an arousing of something, a stirring of the heart. That beginning of what I call the call of the wild, that lone wolf's call at night, you know? And even though the machinery of life becomes the hubbub of most of our rhythms, and the dispensation of life moving in a particularly fast and busy pace, still, even in the thickest New York City, midday, Manhattan moment, you can hear it. If you just pause, you can hear it. And so most of us have been driven by what we can barely perceive, and yet it is such a significant sound in our life, isn't it? It's almost vibratory. It's almost cellular, how its compelling nature, again and again, when we ignore it, it seems to be lost for a while, only to float up like flotsam and jetsam. It's the flotsam, I think. Never could get those two. Better metaphor, it's like a cork in the water. That no matter what hits it and it goes under, it pops up again. Pops up again. And I certainly, in this weekend, so honored the fact that that call of the lone wolf is in every one of us, regardless of age, regardless of circumstance. 55,000 people at Quest Field. And for a moment, there was a genuine resonance, a genuine listening to that call of the wild. And I don't think that there were very many people that superficially raised their hand to commit towards that intention. And I don't believe people really understand what they did when they raised their hand. They might have thought it was just a nice thing to do, but if there was any sincerity behind that being raised, that voice, that call of the wild becomes emphatic. You can't let it go when you reinforce it with intentionality. It becomes like a stone in your shoe. You can't walk without feeling it. And yes, you can cover it over for a long period of time, but then there's a moment when you read a newspaper or you listen to the radio when the pain of the world seeps in beyond our need to distract ourselves from it, when we are just quiet enough and our heart is touched and we let that pain in and we remember that moment when we made that commitment. And many of us turned to tears. I did all weekend long. And today as well, as I went to a breakfast with His Holiness and Desmond Tutu, watching them poke at each other like children in such childful joy, and yet talk also in the most sincere terms about apartheid and the desolation of Tibet. And yet in the middle of that, to find access to the laughter and joy. And to feel that the world has come into their lives fully in ways that we probably don't know the depth of the pain that they've faced. But that they can sit in the midst of that and find the joy as well. Isn't that what we're here about? The authentic way of the heart. The authentic way of the heart. Isn't that what these 10 ox herding pictures are taking us? On a journey to authenticity. To something that is true, regardless of how much life piles upon us, how much we think our meaningful life and flood it over the call of this authenticity. How we lose our way, as these pictures depict. This man, not easily seen, I think, from the back of the room, but it's a man who is just kind of lost, like he's blind. And this one, who smaller, and he's like looking around with under a tree, doesn't know where direction he's going, doesn't have any bearing, except he needs to look, because the heart needs to look, doesn't it? It can't stop looking. It can't stop searching. It can't say, enough of this nonsense, I'm going back and work for a living. You can't forget. It's the itch that cannot be scratched. Right? And this series of 10 pictures is not a progression. It is a misunderstanding to think that it is a progression. It is a quieting. It's not as if we have it at one moment and on picture five, we don't have it at one moment, but on picture five we do. It's that we have it on picture one. And in some ways, picture one is picture 10. But we haven't quieted enough to even recognize that facet of ourselves. And so we keep acting as if there's nothing authentic in us. So these pictures and these talks will give us just a brief cross-section of what it means to travel this landscape of the spiritual. And along the way, we'll touch base with some fundamental principles that we need to renew ourselves again and again. It's a little bit like being a professional sports player and going back to the fundamentals of that particular sport. How to block, tackle, throw, or hit, or whatever our particular sport may be. That those cannot be practiced enough, because they're, whatever we build our lives and our spiritual lives upon, it rests upon those fundamentals. So in this sense, when we start talking about the 10 oxherding pictures and going back to picture one, we return to that fresh innocence of newness. What is all this? What's going on here? When we were dazed, like these men in these pictures, wondering what's going on. And perhaps we were as close to picture 10 when we genuinely sat down the first time and said, what is this about? And we met our meditation with a question. A genuine curiosity, a genuine openness. Because very quickly it starts showing us what we are about, and we become thickened within the conditioning and the repetition of seeing ourselves. And we build an attitude towards ourselves, just as if we were the same attitude we'd have for someone who we lived as a partner with for 20 years. That same attitude, self-attitude, is generated in our meditation, or can be generated in our meditation. I've seen this before. I've heard you before. Do I have to listen to this again? And so to journey back to the innocence of the initial search, to get in touch with the call of the wild, the lone wolf that lives within us, and not to be so sophisticated in what we do that we don't recognize that call anymore. It drives me, and I hope it drives you. Because why else would you raise your hand with 55,000 other people and genuinely say, I want to live this way? You see, something's happening on this planet. And may it just be in time. When Oprah and Eckhart Tolle match up and 2 million people access their dialogues, beautiful dialogues. And if you haven't listened to them, please. But that the icon of of television, Oprah. And then I said, so I'm very interested in that. I want to know what language people are tuning into here. What can 2 million people hear? It's not Buddhism, and it's not Christianity. See, sectarianism will never have a mass appeal, right? If you have to come through the Buddhist path, forget it. So on the stage today, for those of you who went today, there were, I don't know how many, but probably 10 different religious traditions being offered and expressed. And each one of them had a voice beautiful to behold. Hearing the wisdom of the Catholic nun, or the Sufi, or the Vedantist. And you hear it. You see it. We think we've got it here, or it's not that. It's more inclusive. It's much more than that. Is a lone wolf's call our provision only? Of course not. In fact, if it were, I wouldn't even want to be a part of this because it excludes too many people. I'd leave it, and I'd go out and wander. I really would. What good is it if it's just for us? But because it's not for us, because it is served throughout humanity, then, okay, this is our particular form. We can dance within this form without excluding anyone. And then we can listen to how this call directs us. And for many of us here, the direction of this call is through the practice, through this particular orientation and direction. So we need to understand it. We're not blind. We're not just bumping into rocks and trees and the thicket of things. I was once, I taught in New Zealand, and the guy that was, I was on, it was in deep bush, and it was, the meditation center was way out in the country in very deep, thick bush. And the person who was the director of the meditation center had was sort of hyperactive. And he was going to show me around. But 2 feet ahead of me, I couldn't see a thing. And so he'd get 3 feet ahead of me, and I was like, ah! And then the sounds would start fading, and I would like call out and even turn around. It was this enormous panic. You see, that's when we start on this path. We don't know where the call is coming from. We feel it. But is it coming from the outside? What is this urge? And what is the urge asking from us? What is the direction the urge needs to take? What is it that satisfies this urge? And in the first part of it, we don't know. So, for instance, I did everything. I mean, I did everything. If I heard about it and it sounded good, I'd do it. And it wasn't making any sense to me, but, I mean, who was I? Right? So, I mean, I don't know. How I ever got through those 2 years, probably 2 years of just whatever I thought was appropriate to do, it wasn't, I mean, it was all in the Be Here Now handbook of life, right? The handbook of. But I didn't have any direction. I had no feeling for how all of this coalesces, how it forms into this perfect package. See, none of this ox-herding picture makes any sense if you don't understand the 10th picture from the first. We just walk, instead of walking through the frames, you just walk around the circle of one frame. What is this? What is this? And in the innocence of sitting down in the early phases of our spiritual life, we are so close, yet our belief system is so strongly counterintuitive to what is actually occurring. In that sense of wonder and mystery, we are as close to the call of the wild as we can become. as we will ever be. In the moment of an inquisition, in the moment of a question, in the moment of uncertainty. Yet this uncertainty, this searching uncertainty, is uncertainty that is scattered and chaotic. It's not a quiet uncertainty. It's not beaten willing to reside in quiet with uncertainty. It's a noisy uncertainty. It's the mind screaming that it needs to go somewhere and has no idea where it needs to go. And in this world that is plotted, especially this culture, it's plotted against following that call. And not so that there's some kind of master plan. Well, there is, but it's just unconscious. To keep us off balance from that call. To keep us away from what is authentic. And therefore, we will be subservient to the culture and what it says we need in order to be a functional person within it. But it has nothing to do with the authenticity. You see? So at some point, each one of us in our hearts have to say enough. Has that enough come from us? If it hasn't, I don't know what will bring it forth, because we're on a moment of crisis, and I know some of you don't like me to use these words, but how else can I express what the passion in me is except to point to the crisis that humanity is facing? And have we had enough? What will lead us out of this? And so when we get going in this spiritual surge, some of us feel like we've had enough, feel like we've ended this. We've had enough. We don't know where we're going. And some of us actually contemplate suicide. I know I did. I thought, if this is life, and I'm not up to it, what good is it? And I used to keep suicide in my hip pocket. And I thought, well, if the government got so bad, I'd just kill myself, and that would be okay. So then it was like being terminally ill and having the pills that could take your life earlier than the terminal illness would if the terminal illness got so bad that you couldn't stand it anymore. And so I would just play with that idea. And that despair is the despair, it's both the despair of wisdom and the despair of ignorance. You see? Because genuinely, life lived as most people live it, circumstantially, within the cultural overlay of what's appropriate and how good it's supposed to be, isn't worth living. Not when you listen to the call of the wild. And so, you see, the despair is a wisdom. Well, everybody else seems, but from the point of view of the person having the despair, it feels as if you're the only one. We're the only one. Everyone else has got it together, we think. Except if you scratch just below the surface of the skin of anyone out there who we think has it together, you'll find that they're frantic in their own need to put a rest to their despair. But we don't talk at that level. We avoid that level of seriousness. And so we are driven by something not working, but having no idea what can work. So we come upon something, and it may be within a religion. We renew an acquaintance with a religion that has been with us our whole life. But for me, I had to leave the religion I was in and find a new awakening within a cultural religion, tradition, that I knew nothing about. And so that I could bring that sense of beginner's mind, that sense of newness, that sense of wonder and mystery, and not have the heritage of how I have felt about being forced to go to church and being an acolyte and all the other things I was when I was a boy, follow me into this sense of mystery, this sense of exploration. You see, the search. Searching for the ox is searching for what's authentic. I just like the word authentic. I don't want to make it too complicated with Buddha nature and all, you know, just what's authentic in us. Are your thoughts authentic? Are your emotions authentic? That's where psychology lays us open. That's the reality of what our psychologists tell us. Trying to rearrange the content of our lives in such a way that we can at least be at ease with ourselves. Please, just wait. And so early on, in particular, lots of mistakes are made. In fact, we are mistake-prone all along this path, but in particular, early on, because we don't have a sense of what authenticity is. And so we look for authenticity as we have projected it to be, maybe in appearance. If somebody looks holy, then that might satisfy us. Or they speak biblically, or they have an otherworldly gaze. I've fallen for that one. I was just getting involved in this, and I was so hungry. And I was in Cincinnati, Ohio, and I. Nobody in Cincinnati in 1970s, early 70s, was doing any of this. There was one person, Lilius Yoga on TV. Lilius, whatever her name was. So I wrote her a letter, which she never responded to. And so suddenly this guy shows up at the apartment who claims to be a spiritual teacher, and he's going to teach us meditation. So we gather in the common room, and we first have to pay our $10 to come in, and then he said, I'll let you here for $10, but after that it's $100 a session, or whatever the equivalent was back then. I just remember a large sum. And he said, I sit down, and he says, okay, so this is the first lesson. Follow your breath until a thought comes. And if the thought is something you pursue, then dwell on that thought and embellish that thought, and you'll create that reality. I said, I don't know much about meditation, but that sounds awful. It sounds to me like the marketplace. And I'm not interested in replicating the marketplace. So I didn't go back, and besides that, I couldn't afford it. So there's a sense in us, what's authentic. There's a sense. It's as if we know the sound of a real wolf. And we forsake that sense of what's authentic because other people are going towards what seems to us to be inauthentic. Like many of those people in the room were like eyes wide open. Why, you know, they were really... I thought, and so we fall back on our doubt. Is it just me? And the doubt, since we believe so strongly in our unworthiness, outweighs that call, that authenticity, that direction towards authenticity. And so we don't follow that. And so we keep getting off base. Over and over again, especially when it's a very faint wolf's call. I mean, it's way out there, and you can just barely hear it in yourself. You're just coming up out of the muck to be able to hear it. And we're tripping over ourselves, and yet this sense of expectation can be so high. Have you felt that? This sense of anticipation. Oh, you know, where we've given it so much, so we've weighed in so heavily on the potential of what this could do for us. And when I teach the beginning class, I watch out for people when I give after a couple of classes and they come up to me and say, oh, this is so wonderful. And I know they're heading for the... Because it's not. Is it? No, it's hideous. You do it because it's the only thing that satisfies the call, isn't it? Huh? So if you could get around that, we wouldn't do this, neither would I. But it's the only way towards our authenticity that I know of that works for me. I'm not saying it's the only way, please. I'm saying that it's the way for me. And each of us have our own way. And so when we find a technique or a method that allows that clarity, it's like listening to whales, you know? Oh, there's just something about hearing a whale. It's that. You see, that's it. It's the same thing. And you just, and because this practice, first conceptually, and for some people we lose it in the concepts, because conceptually, see, we have to know whether this is mind-based or heart-based practice. If it's mind-based practice, then for a long period of time, reading and intellectual pursuit and philosophy, spouting all the philosophy, satisfies a certain intellectual curiosity. But the call goes so much deeper than that. So when we're finished reading the book, many people have said to me, I can't read anymore. I said, don't. And to obey that, if we feel it, I can't read anymore. This is it. No more. I can't read anymore. I'm filled up with that. It means the mind is filled. It has far too vast an understanding mentally, and it hasn't moved into the integration of the heart. And at some point, the only thing that satisfies that is the direct experience of life, of seeing, observing, observation. And the journey of that search, the journey pulls us down ever deeper. And whatever method we get involved in to begin with, and we get in here for vastly different reasons. Some is that we bottomed out of life and there's nowhere else to go. Others because we've taken an adjunct practice, that we started to do something like stress reduction or stretching, and it turned into yoga. And then yoga turns into a deepening relationship with body and on, and it just starts, it's like this sinker that just keeps moving down deeper. And every time it moves down deeper, the call gets louder. And it just pulls and pulls at us until we give over to it and stop fighting it. But the reason we fight it is that we don't think it's in us. We think that the search is an external search. And so we spend much of our early years looking externally for sources that satisfy that itch within. And we look for someone who knows, because that has been our studying point in school, teachers, etc. And so there must be somebody around here who knows, and I'll just sit at the feet of that person and be fed and not have to, and get away and not have to do the hard work myself. And there was a Buddhist story of a man who sat there and stared at the Buddha for month after month, and finally, I think the Buddha says, come here. He says, you think you're looking at the real Buddha. The person who sees the Dharma sees the real Buddha. If you want to see me, go to the Dharma in yourself. See, it's instructions like that that we, because every one of us know that in this room. Every one of us knows the way to authenticity. But we bring a lot of laziness, but more importantly than laziness, because I don't really believe we're lazy. I believe that we're scared. I believe that we really feel that we can't do it. That if I gave my full-hearted effort into this search, if I gave over to it, and then it didn't happen for me, what else have I got left to offer? And so one way to sort of pull back upon that full-hearted responsibility and obligation to the search is to do it sort of halfway. And then we can always say, well, I have more to give, but in this tradition, we're not asking you to give as outside of what you're already doing. We're asking you to give over to what you are already doing. So it's not a practice that takes time away from your full embodied life already. It's a practice that embodies your full life already. Every one of us can do that, because it doesn't mean changing a thing. Like one person came to me and said, should I become a monk or should I get married? Like I would know the answer to that. And I said, I don't care what you do, just do it full-heartedly. Because it doesn't make any difference. It doesn't make any difference. And every one of us in the room knows that. And so the sobering fact is that we have to take responsibility for that. See, am I searching from the mind or the heart? I don't know, something's happening here with the Dalai Lama and 50,000 people and Oprah with 2 million. And the words that are being spoken are, I mean, you could crouch them in Buddhism or you could crouch them in Christianity. Blessed be the person who comes into being. Blessed is the person who comes into being prior to birth, said Christ in the Gospel of St. Thomas. So you see, you hear it everywhere. And when you get interested beyond a sectarianism, you want to turn up every rock. You don't care where the rocks take you. And every time you hear something like that, whoa, turn that rock over. Let's explore that one. Let's explore this one. Let's do this one. Do you know? We're always looking for the satisfaction of that call. Could I have her sit up? Thank you. We don't have time. But you see, then the search, this is the beautiful part of this journey, and as we go through frame by frame by frame by frame by frame by frame, we have to take the responsibility within that frame. And so, okay, frame one, we aren't supposed to know anything. We're supposed to bump our heads a lot. Fine, let's bump our heads a lot. But let me give you the resolution of the search. Because we don't want to just search all of our life. We want to have a sense of taking this search in the right orientation to discovery. And the search that looks externally is a search from a sense of self-diminishment. I don't have it in here. I have to find it out there. And so the sense of searching itself is painful. Do you see that? And the more I take steps to validate the search, the more I hurt inside, as long as it's an external procurement. So the more I run after a teaching, the more I run after a teacher, the more I try externally to find satisfaction within, the more I hurt. Because the more I validated the fact that I don't have it. So it's the search that incites the pain to end the search. But we have to have an orientation. See, this is where the responsibility comes. If we're not oriented in the correct direction to pain, so that we actually explore the pain that's arising, we will just try further and further to get away from that pain by continuing the search externally. And thereby assuage the pain we are feeling by discovering something that will allow us to do just that. But when we're oriented correctly to our suffering, to the self-inflicted problem that we create, then we realize the more we run from ourselves, the more we're just going to incite that very thing. And so there's a sobering moment when we have searched enough. You see the subtlety within each one of these frames? This isn't just about the first moment of exhilaration and aha and blissfulness that leads to the crashing of despair, which is part of that frame, but also that each frame itself shows you its totality of all frames within it. If we can develop the right orientation and the right way to listen to what it is that's going on so that we can interpret it correctly, we put an end to the suffering of that frame rather than to perpetuate it. So then, you see, that's when those who have gone before us, the elders and the teachers and the monks and the Buddha, can say, wait a second here. Instead of acting from one's doubt, let's look at it. Instead of being so self-perturbed, let us look at the sense of self-diminishment, and bring forth a different sense of self-acclaim, a different sense of self-affection, of loving-kindness to ourself, for ourself. Instead of just running from this pain and searching out as outside sources to somehow get over it, we have to turn towards it. And it's not a message that many people want to hear. They'd rather hear that if you just embellish your desires, they'll manifest. Or some other false spiritual prophecy. But if we want to satisfy the call, then we have to go in that direction. And suddenly what happens is that the call, the search, is no longer externalized. It becomes this magnet to move inward, to look inside rather than external, to look outside, to satisfy itself. And so we hear of a spiritual teacher here, or hear of this, or hear of this thing. Fine, we may go, but it's not like it's the compelling need of our life, because we realize that if we're feeling that out of balance, we better focus in and see what we're doing to ourselves to create that imbalance, rather than try to satisfy it through the conference or the teacher or the trip to India or the pilgrimage. And so the pain of the search ends the search, which takes us to frame two. Thank you all for your attention. Can we sit for a minute or two? Being quiet with ourselves. No matter what, being quiet with that. And letting the magnetic force of that authenticity pull us inward. Because we're not going to find how to be authentic. We're not going to discover our own authenticity by looking externally. How could we? What's authentic in here? And how are we going to discover that unless we're quiet? Okay. So if there are any comments or questions about anything, I'd be happy to. Yes.
I was thinking about your question that where did the spiritual journey begin? And I think a lot of it sort of began in grief and loss. And that's kind of a nice thing to acknowledge, that that sort of grief and loss is very solid, but kind of thinking it can be a trap, too.
He said that he was reflecting on the question of where did his spiritual search begin, and he says for him it quite likely began in grief and loss. And he was saying that he sees how many people can get involved in the spiritual journey through grief and loss, but that it could be a trap, and would I have any comments about it? There's a tremendous access that loss and grief provides. It accesses what is true on many different levels. One, the irreversibility of change, and the fact that impermanence is everywhere, right? That we live in a state of transition. It breaks through the denial of sustaining anything, doesn't it? And so that can be, it's like breaking your chandelier or something. You know, it's like an irreversible crack, and you can't put it back together again. And so loss, in whatever way it happens, and for some people it has to be a dramatic loss, like loss of a spouse or whatever. For others, it can be just the accumulation of small losses. Takes us to a point of saying, what is this about? What's life about if it's in continuous disarray? If it's continually falling apart in front of my eyes? What can it be about? Now, that's one level of spiritual awakening to the truth, beyond the denial, beyond the sense of permanency that many of us look out through, because conceptually we have such a strong overlay on life, we see the concept of things, we don't see the inherent impermanence that those concepts are overlaid on. Now there's another level of awakening that loss can provide, and that is when loss occurs. There's a moment in which you are without something. It's amazing how quickly the mind can project with expectation where that next foot is going to fall. And when there's a loss, there is a moment in which that foot moves through its footfall, right? It doesn't land. Because there's a hole there. And that hole, if we don't fill it with grief, which takes our eye off the ball, it doesn't land at all. And there's a sense of something else coming through where that reliable source, person, thing, place used to be. And if we don't fill it, which is usually what happens, is that we fill it so quickly with grief that we then move to holding on to that object conceptually, even though it's not there in reality anymore, and grieving it, which takes our eye off the fact of what it is that comes through when something is really missing. Now, the downfall of that, is that you can become self-pitying, you can make it into a role or an image like anybody else, and say, tell me your life story, and you go through endless series of grief and how miserable we've been. And that's just, I mean, anything can turn into a self-created image. It's interesting, I was doing some breath work with Stan Grof, and I was actually assisting Jack Kornfield. This was maybe 20-some years ago, on one of those holotrophic breathwork seminars, which was very interesting. So I was doing it myself. Jack was monitoring me. And I was doing hospice work at the same time, and I fell into grief. But it wasn't just memories or things. It was like embodied grief. It was like a black hole of grief where there wasn't anything but grief. And as the body does, it just started sobbing. And then the spotter, when they think you're out of control, will come over to you and see if you need to be aroused from that particular fixed response. And so he came over and started shaking me, and now, you know, I'm a hospice worker. This is where I want to be. I was exploring this thing. I don't care what the body and mind were doing and sobbing. And I said, no, stop. You say something, I think it's stop. And then they go away. Because I was in my element. And I took that thing, and I didn't move from it, and I went right through. And it left me with the spiritual grace of grief. To this day, I can't think of grief free of the spiritual grace that's held within it. So I'm not speaking from secondhand or some kind of conceptual. I'm really speaking from direct experience. It's an amazing emotion because you have you have nothing to hold on to. You have nothing. And if we don't fall back into the self-pity of that nothing, it actually shows us nothing. Reveals nothing. Where we've counted on something and there's nothing, it reveals that nothing. And it reveals our nothingness within it. So that's all I have to say on that. Yes. Yes. Right. Yes, well, that's a good one. She said she appreciated the comment that we're not lazy, that we're more afraid I talked about going into pain, but what about going into fear? Well, I would have answered this very differently about 6 weeks ago, but having had a series of rather stark experiences with fear, that showed its how entrenched it is as a conditioning. I was I had some problems with my lungs, and I became afraid of sleeping. When I started to fall asleep, I would jolt myself back up because I was afraid I wouldn't breathe. And so for 2 days I didn't sleep. So you can't go on that way forever, right? And so Ellen said, well, why don't you do some loving kindness? Well, I thought, that's a novel idea. So I started to work with loving kindness, but I did it in a different way, not may I be free of... That didn't really satisfy anything for me. But what I would do when fear arose is I would find the safety and freedom of danger within it. Now, I can't explain that, except that I would not accept reality as closed down, because I know it's not. There's some, the cells know that it's, the fear is a mind's contracted reality, but that there is safety and freedom of danger in it. And once you embrace it with safety, it can't form as fear. I don't know if this is making any sense to you. And as it, what it can't form is, I mean, there are many ways to talk about it, and that is, you know, in presence, fear can't, when you hold presence and you don't let the mind convince you that the future is going to arrive, so that's one way of it. But the way I was feeling it, because of the meta phrase, may I be safe and free of danger, is that I would come up, I'd wake up startled, I could feel the fear pattern start, I would bring forth that phrase, and I would actually abide in the phrase rather than saying the phrase. May I abide? And then I would abide, and the fear just could not form. And I thought, whoa, this is really interesting. You see, that's a very different way than saying, oh, may, you know, using the phrases... more as a panacea from having to feel fear, but finding the truth of the phrases within fear. So the way I feel about fear now is that we have to have a relationship to it, and it's an ongoing, it's ongoing, and there are so many different levels and ways that we begin to prove its untruth, but it takes exposure. It takes us being exposed to it. I mean, you can't prove something's not true by turning your back on it and pretending that it's not true. You expose yourself to it and you prove its untruth. And as our courage develops, so does our capacity to stay steady in relationship to that fear. So it's not an, it's to give yourself a lot of patience on this one and a lot of gentleness, because it really unfolds as these 10 frames of ox herding pictures unfold. And it does. I am not making any statement about having or coming to the end of fear. I just know it's not true. And with that, each time it builds upon that realization. Okay. Thank you all very much.